we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
Welcome to Hard Facts, the show that gets to the heart of the matter with me, John White. In 2017, 100 years after the Balfour Declaration gave the land of one people to a second people on the part of a third people, the cause of the Palestinians is the cause of humanity in our time. Their plight shames a world that has for decades turned its back on justice and international law in service to exceptionalism. Compounding their suffering is a narrative proffered by Israel and supported by Western governments that it is Israel, a military superpower and advanced economy, rather than the Palestinians who are under threat of extinction. Military occupation, siege, illegal settlements, collective punishment, large-scale military assaults, targeted assassinations, imprisonment without trial or due process. These and more are the depredations suffered daily and regularly by a people whose only crime is to live on land coveted by another people, whose claim to it is justified on grounds of religious obscurantism and colonialism. For far too long, the Palestinian people have endured, waiting for the so-called international community to finally emerge from decades of hypocrisy and double standards where the state of Israel is concerned. And I have no hesitation in saying that rather than a state interested in democracy and human rights, Israel is a rogue state. Enough is enough. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Well, I'm delighted to be joined on today's show by Ramzi Baroud, writer, author and journalist. Ramzi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, John.
Now, there's a lot to get through here. We've had an interesting few weeks, just over a month in fact, since the UN Security Council broke with tradition and actually condemned Israel for illegal settlements expansion. That has been followed by the Paris peace talks, which if you blinked, you would have missed them. But I think the most interesting development, Ramzi, and I wonder if you agree, is the talks that recently took place in Moscow between representatives of Hamas, Fatah and Islamic Jihad for the first time were involved, and out of which they formed a unity government, a national council. I consider this very, very significant, especially the fact that these talks were held in Moscow, which merely confirms Russia's renewed importance on the international stage, particularly with regard to the Middle East. How do you analyse where we are with regard to justice for the Palestinians?
Well, that's a tough question, John, because the question of justice for Palestinians has been on wait, on hold, yes, for about 70 years now. So I really rather cautious when I approach this question after all these years. But I would say that what has been happening lately is there is something promising in the air. And the fact that Donald Trump is now officially the president of the United States might be good news for Palestinians in a sense. I think Palestinians are now realizing that the Washington, door is sealed, is shut closed, and they have to find alternative ways to deal with their problems, with their factionalism, and perhaps to seek alternative regional and international leadership, thus the Moscow talks, in my opinion, who could be possibly more sincere. Actually, anybody can be more sincere than the so-called honest peace broker in Washington, and could approach this conflict with a little bit of humility and a little bit of balance that could, in fact, help Palestinians move forward, at least to articulate a national agenda. That's what we need right now, in my opinion. We need to have a united national agenda, not necessarily a united government, but a national agenda that is championed by the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, that represents Palestinians at home and in diaspora.
Okay.
If we can actually achieve that, I think that would be a very important first step towards renewing the national commitment, or what we call in Palestine the constant of our struggle.
Okay. I was interested to hear you say that you thought Trump's presidency may be a significant event in terms of pushing the cause of the Palestinians forward, because I see it quite differently, actually. I mean, he's talked about moving the US embassy in Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Surely this would trigger a third intifada, would it not?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, no, I'm not disagreeing at all. The man is a menace. is a terrifying human being. But I think maybe this is what we need.
Yeah.
In other words, if you looked back at the Clinton administration, look at the George W. Bush administration, which was really closer to Trump than to the Clinton-Obama style. And then look at the Obama administration. You know, on one hand, they funded Israeli wars. They supported Israel blindly in every international institution and convention. They really gave a blank check to Israel to do as it pleases with Palestinians. Yet on the other hand, they continued to talk about peace and freedom and human rights. That double speak was essential for the Palestinian Authority and for the so-called moderate Arabs.
Yes.
It gave them the needed fuel to kind of perpetuate this illusion that there is something happening, that there is a peace process. We just need to try a little bit harder. A conference in Sharm el Sheikh, a conference in Paris, a conference in Washington, a conference here and there, and we will keep the charade going as long as everybody is getting paid at the end of the day. Trump is now going to give everyone a very clear start. The man is a menace. He's racist. He's going to do all the terrible things that Israel wants him to do. But sometimes you have to be careful what you wish for.
Indeed.
Because if indeed the settlement is moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and the rest of the settlement, sorry, the embassy, and the rest of the settlements are annexed legally by the Israeli Knesset, then there will be an intifada, and there will be no other option but to redefine the struggle, as we have been pushing for years, to a one-state struggle, to equal rights in the land between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea. And that's exactly what we want.
Indeed. Robert Fisk wrote a very hard-hitting article in response to the Paris peace talks. I'd like to read a brief passage from it because I think it encapsulates the situation very well and many of the themes that you've just articulated. He writes, and I quote, "Anyone who's visited the West Bank these past few years, looked at the Jewish colonies built on stolen Arab land, witnessed the occupation and the filth of Gaza, and observed its brutal Hamas militia leaders, and realised that Netanyahu will soon be the most left-wing member of his increasingly racist government, knows very well that the two-state solution vanished long ago." Your thoughts, Ramsey?
Oh, yes, that's precisely it. In the Arab-Israeli, so-called Arab-Israeli conflict in the Middle East right now, we have two realities that are happening side by side. A reality that we know is based on facts and facts on the ground and the reality of every day. And the other imagined reality, the one they talk about in Washington and in Paris and elsewhere. And that reality about a two-state solution and a peace process and all of this is long dead and buried. In fact, in a recent article I wrote, I said that the two-state solution is not dead. It never existed in the first place. The two-state solution was a Washington idea, a strategy to prolong this conflict on behalf of Israel. It started very early on in the 1980s when they wanted to engage the PLO in talks in Tunis and so forth. And it's this carrot that Palestinians have been chasing after for years and years and years. And there has never been any serious intentions to make it happen. I mean, think about it this way, John. The United States is supposedly the most powerful, militarily powerful country in the world, has the largest political clout in history, more than any other empire. And it is so keen, supposedly, on the two-state solution. Yet, somehow, there is absolutely not one single step taken in the right direction to achieve a two-state solution. How is that even possible? How do we account for this contradiction? This is not about the Washington having unwise policy. Washington never had that intention in the first place.
Never been an honest broker, and the Palestinians have never had a serious partner for peace. I've always been interested in the historical context to this issue. The Israelis, as we know, sought the sponsorship of Western imperialism to create their country, their land. And from the outset, they were intent on dispossessing the Palestinians. They were never interested in the partition plan that was formulated, in, I think, in 1946. Plan Dalet, we know, which was the catalyst for the Nakba, when 750,000 Palestinian men, women and children were forced from their homes in a mass program of ethnic cleansing to make way for Jewish European settlers. So there's always been a lot of mendacity surrounding this, if not duplicity. But one interesting quote from one of the Israeli leaders that I find really interesting, it gives us an understanding of what the Israelis are really looking for and what their motives are, is the quote by the famous quote by Golda Meir in 1969, the then Israeli Prime Minister, when she said, "There were no Palestinians." Now, people take that as a statement of historical fact, when in truth, I think it was a statement of intent. And I think that, I don't know if you agree, but I think that the whole purpose behind the Zionist state is to make life so intolerable for the Palestinians that they will leave of their own accord. They've never been interested in giving them anything like a state. They've dehumanized them, demonized them to such an extent that the poison of racism has corroded Israeli society from top to bottom, that even their own people would not allow, or certainly a majority of their own people would not allow, anything approximating to a Palestinian state, a functioning state, to exist side by side with Israel. Do you agree with that?
Oh, fully, fully. Israel is crippled by fear. Yeah. Fear of an idea, an irrational idea that they have instilled in their own people from the very beginning. They wanted to establish a state that is based on purity of race and blood. Which is absolutely ridiculous in modern times. And it's even more ridiculous that they are trying to actually sustain that. They think it is actually possible to do this forever and ever. And for all of those years, they have given every indication that they basically want the land, they don't want the people. Rather, let me correct that a little bit. For a while, they wanted the people as cheap laborers.
Yes.
So they used Palestinians as cheap laborers from 1967, after they occupied the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem and made it impossible for Palestinian economy to stand on its own feet under occupation, thus pushing the vast majority of Palestinians to serve as cheap laborers, building Israeli homes and factories and roads and bridges and so forth and so on, all the way until the Intifada, until the second Intifada, when they realized, no, the price of incorporating Palestinians in our society, even as much lesser beings than everybody else, is still too high. So they found alternative laborers to exploit from elsewhere, and they reached the conclusion, and growingly so, that basically we can't do without with the Palestinians. They would have... So the ethnic cleansing mentality, what they call Plan Dalet, that was based on ethnically cleansing the land, that never really concluded. That was not over with the so-called independence of Israel.
They just never finished the job.
Yes, absolutely. They are still following the same mindset of those years. And right now, the vast majority of Israelis believe that ethnic cleansing is an acceptable idea. And that is terrifying for one simple reason. We are not talking about a group of extremists on the side, you know, like that group of Kahana High and these other radicals. These groups are now in the center stage of the Israeli government.
Mm-hmm.
The likes of Naftali Bennett and the likes of Regev and the likes of Netanyahu himself. And of course, Avigdor Lieberman. These people are very much the champions of ideas of ethnic cleansing. And now they are the ones who are steering Israeli politics and policy. And they are going to be there for years and years to come.
Indeed, fascinating. Let me halt here for a quick break and we'll return. And I'd like to talk about the role of the BDS campaign and the shift that seems to have been taking place within Fatah. Don't go anywhere. Join us after the break. Hard Facts. Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts. I'm discussing the situation with vis-a-vis the Palestinians and Israel with Ramzi Baroud, writer, author and journalist. Before we return to our discussion, as is our wont on this show, we like to hear what the public thinks. And earlier we asked, do you consider Israel to be a rogue state? Let's have a listen.
Yes, it's a rogue state. It flouts many international laws. I don't know how many it is. I think it's over 50. So I would say in that region and worldwide, yeah, definitely rogue state.
The thing with this is, again, you want to differentiate between the stance of the government and the everyday man, woman and child in Israel. And ultimately, both these countries want a solution. And they go on about this two-state solution feasibly as being the only realistic thing to solve something which has been going on since, oh, it's well over 50 years now. And I think you look at the settlement issue being brought up of late, and there's a lot of hate thrown about, and I think ultimately both countries just want this issue that has been going on for years resolved.
seems like Israel is like handy for the West to have as like a state that's like on their side and against its surrounding neighbours. So it's like handy for the West to have Israel there, which is why they probably won't apply as much pressure as they should.
Truth is, when you look at it more closely, is that you see Jewish settlements being built in Palestine with like sort of fortresses, from what I've read in different medias and so on. But this little by little seems that it increases Israel's influence overall.
Ramsey, as we heard from these Vox Pops, the level of public consciousness with regards to this issue is remarkable now. I remember when I first became involved in the Palestinian issue as a proponent of Palestinian human rights around 20 years ago, it was very, very difficult to make arguments in favour of the Palestinians, and there's been a remarkable shift in the last couple of decades. And this brings me on to the role of the boycott, divestment and sanctions campaign. This has really changed the game, I feel, and I feel that a lot of these governments that are now feeling minded to criticise Israel, however tepid, but criticise them they are increasingly, this can only have been informed by BDS, and this is why I think Israel is so exercised by BDS. Indeed, Netanyahu himself has gone out of his way to target BDS, and governments such as the British government have gone out of their way to delegitimise BDS. What's your thoughts on the role of BDS, and how do you see the impact it's having and has had up to now?
I think that there are several factors that are contributing to this rise of awareness in public opinion around the world. Even the United States itself, despite the fact that the mainstream media here is still very much in control. And that is, in my opinion, the new format, or rather the new media platforms that exist, the new media technologies that made, that, you know, in the old days, I remember whenever the New York Times would write a certain editorial on Palestine, Israel, you know, it will be the discussion of all intellectuals all over the world, and we start trying to kind of deconstruct what does that editorial mean in terms of this and that. Now, really, I mean, if the New York Times write an editorial, big deal. You know, we have access to thousands upon thousands of very legitimate and important sources. And even a child in Gaza can be a source. A teenager blogging from the war in Gaza can actually be a major source for various media, you know, because he is there at the right time, at the right place.
Yes, interesting.
So that, I think that had a great deal of impact. The second thing is that BDS kind of capitalized on that moment. I think without the changing nature of media, I don't think BDS would have succeeded in really reaching out and changing hearts and minds and getting civil society involved, from being a recipient of news, recipient of bad news mostly, to active participants in the process. I think this made a huge difference. So in other words, we took a global issue and we localized.
Yes.
It became about Ireland and South Africa. It becomes about, you know, a small town in, you know, near Vancouver, Canada, as much as it is about a country. So that active participation of ordinary people helped them break that sense of frustration that, what can I do? I am helpless in this. No, actually, there is a degree of moral accountability on you as a citizen. You can call upon your government, upon your city council, upon whatever within your immediate space, and you can actually register a difference, make a difference. That's why Israel is very upset, because traditionally Israel has been counting on the fact that they have shaped the narrative from beginning to an end.
Yes.
You know, they painted the Palestinians to be horrible, horrifying, you know, terrorists doing awful things, and Israel is barely trying to survive, a little drop in the sea of Arabs and multitudes of Muslims.
Yes.
But that perception is just not there anymore, or at least in many parts of the world, it's just really fizzling out, and there's a whole new perception going on. Even the gentleman who was saying, you know, no, you have to differentiate between the government and the people.
Yes.
In your broadcast earlier, actually, the Israeli society and government are a representation of each other as far,
yes,
as right-wing ultra-nationals. There's no question about it.
Yes.
But even that viewpoint is considered so progressive compared to the point of view we used to have 20, 30 years ago, where it was all about Arabs wants to throw, you know, Jews to the sea.
Yes.
You rarely hear that narrative anymore. And that's why, again, why Israel is particularly worried about this trend, because they are not the masters of the narrative anymore, and anybody can be involved and anybody can make a difference. And this is why BDS is successful, because we can't face Israel militarily, at least not now. But what we can do is we can eat up, you know, into the heart of the Israeli national narrative and offer and imagine an alternative discourse. And that discourse is actually registering with people, not just as an idea, but again, as a campaign in which they can be part.
Yes, and also the calumny, the dread word anti-Semitism, no longer has anything like the impact it used to, because it was overused to describe anyone who dares raise any criticism of Israel, no matter how tepid or how soft they may be, because that's always a threat. Because I think it's in Israel's interest to normalise its oppression and treatment of the Palestinian people, and obviously now it's not succeeding. I think a very important aspect of BDS is the way that it's chipping away at the moral foundations upon which this apartheid state rests, because obviously apartheid can only succeed to the extent that people accept it, and people accept, as you say, the dominant narrative put forward, not just by Israel, but obviously its very powerful and influential supporters throughout the West. And also another aspect as well, we can't overlook the atrocities that are being committed by the Israelis, the IDF,
absolutely,
against the Palestinians, Cast Lead in 2008, 2009, Protective Edge in 2014, and the daily depredations, which I touched upon in my intro. You know, you can no longer be overlooked in an age of so much awareness and so where so much information is available, subverting the mainstream. But you think this is also having an effect, though, on Fatah? Because obviously we've seen a shift now. Fatah's willing to move away from its role. I think Mahmoud Abbas, one of the most moderate leaders the Palestinians have ever had, if not the most moderate, was a de facto agent of the Israelis for many, many years. And I detect a shift in his position. He realises that he was in a cul-de-sac. He was being used and abused by the Israelis and their American partners. And now he's moving more towards his own people vis-a-vis these talks and reconciliation talks with Hamas and even Islamic Jihad. These kind of talks would have been unthinkable on the part of Fatah 5, 6, 7 years ago. What do you think is happening within Fatah? Do you see a shift?
I wouldn't say that there is a shift as of yet. I think there are various indications that there is much frustration on the part of the rank and file,
yes,
within the Fatah movement. But this frustration has been going on for a while. The way that Fatah kind of got sucked into this to become almost like an enabler of the Israeli occupation is not actually dated back to Oslo, the Oslo peace process in 1993 and the signing of Oslo in 94, but rather to an earlier phase where Fatah was growing irrelevant in various Arab countries. It was growing larger, you know, more corrupt and well-funded. And there was a lot of infighting going on within the Fatah movement. And I think it had a lot to do with the fact that they had to change their colors repeatedly in order for them to win the acceptance of the United States. Because if you remember, you know, you're a student of history, Fatah had to jump through so many hoops in order for them to prove that they are worthy of being engaged by the Americans and by the Israelis. Well, in the process of doing so, the leadership, at least the top cadre within Fatah, has been duly pacified. And that was the group of people that actually led the PLO and the Palestinians to Oslo and post-Oslo and managed this entire phase. Now, there's always been this revolutionary part of Fatah that was never happy about it. They exist, they are there, but they've never really been given the reins of leadership. They've never really been given access. Whenever there is any attempt at them really kind of coming to the fore and challenging the dominant leadership within the Fatah movement, they've always been crushed. Yasser Arafat found a more peaceful way of dealing with them. Mahmoud Abbas literally just crushed them, put them in jails, arrested them, and so forth and so on. But now that his grip on power is weakening, not just because of old age, but because Oslo has completely failed. There is not many Palestinians who would still say, well, you know, give the peace process another chance. We've been doing this for 23 years. So that argument that Fatah has won in the beginning of this process is not there anymore. So there is definitely pressure within that movement to find an alternative way. But the challenge, I think, within Fatah is that they would have to find a new foundation for that alternative way. Is Fatah open to sharing powers within other factions? Because Fatah dominated the PLO since the 60s until today. Are they really truly willing to share powers? Are they willing to understand that a vision for an independent, free Palestine does not hinge only upon a few individuals within one single group within the larger movement? Is this a Palestinian cause or is this a Fatah cause? And I think this is the soul searching than the Fatah people would have to do in order for them to win the love and support of the Palestinian people and to truly manage to work with the other existing groups.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Moving on to Gaza, Ramsey, Robert Fisk was quite excoriating with regard to Hamas, whom he described, and I quote, as a brutal Hamas militia leaders. I think he's been a bit harsh. Hamas are certainly not my cup of tea in terms of the kind of society that I would like to live in. But I don't live in Palestine. I don't live under the conditions that the Palestinians of Gaza in particular are dealing with. And Hamas really is, in a true sense, a product of Israeli policy vis-a-vis the Palestinians. I don't know what you think of Hamas's role. I think they lost their way a bit with regard to events in Syria, but you cannot dispute their courage. I think that was shown to the entire world in the context of Operation Protective Edge, when against overwhelming odds they managed to inflict some quite significant casualties on Israelis, certainly relative to past military engagements. But do you share Robert Fisk's treatment of Hamas as brutal, or do you see that? Do you have a more nuanced analysis of Hamas, their provenance, their emergence, and their development?
Yes, I actually do not share views on Hamas. Part of it because I was born and raised in Gaza.
Yes.
And the main Hamas leadership actually came from my refugee camp. So I kind of like was part of that. I remember the first time, the Hamas masked men stood in the top of the, in a high ground in the martyrs' graveyard and made the first declaration on the name of Hamas. And we were all looking at each other, like, what is he talking about? What is this Hamas thing? And people start whispering, trying to understand what is going on here. And I've been part of that involvement, and I wrote about it. I wrote books. I wrote numerous articles. No, it's not. It really is, as you said, is a product of circumstances that were not really shaped, neither by the Israeli intelligence nor shaped by Qatar or Saudi Arabia. They were shaped by the occupation and the violence of the occupation and the suffering of the people. Most of the leadership were really refugees from Palestine, and many of them still maintain rather humble existence in the Gaza Strip and elsewhere.
Yes.
But I think ultimately it emerged that Hamas, when it comes to resistance, is really quite fierce. And they have, we are yet to see a stronger example. What made the Hamas resistance different than the various resistance in the past is that it's the first time that you actually see a Palestinian group that manages to kind of go to, kind of feed organically on the resistance that exists within society. This is why Israel is having such a difficult time eradicating Hamas, as they have eradicated various military resistance that was shown by Palestinians, because it is society that is evolving and is being part of that movement. And this is why I think their model has been very successful. But they have really proved to be quite amateurs when it comes to politics.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a great deal of discussion that can be done about this. Someone could say, well, what's happening in the Arab world was way beyond anybody's ability to predict and to play the game right. Others would disagree. I think they made some horrendous mistakes, really. I think their alliance with Qatar was a mistake. I don't think that they should have been involved in Syria whatsoever. Just not because we don't care about the fate of the Syrians, but we can barely keep up the struggle against Israel, in Gaza and the West Bank. I don't think Hamas had any business playing a regional game. But that does not and should not deny the fact that if it were really not for Hamas, the Oslo culture would have dominated Palestine. Perhaps the whole thing would have been sorted out exactly the way Israel would wanted it from the very beginning. It is Hamas that really did manage to fill that huge gap that was opened by Fatah and even by the socialist movement. That really most of the resistance is going on right now is that of NGOs and press releases. And it's these kids in Gaza that managed to organize and make an army and push the Israelis back for all of these years. We can't deny that, but we cannot pretend that they have played the political game right. I think they made some really, really terrible mistakes. And the future of the movement, I think, is going to hinge on their ability to kind of really move themselves away from the mess, the regional political mess of the Arabs, and not allow themselves to be used as pawns by Qatar or Turkey or anybody else, and to really kind of try to find their way back into the center of Palestinian society in order for them to win their credence and win the support that they enjoyed for many years.
Ramzi Beirut, thank you very much for joining me on Hard Facts. This brings us to the end of another show. However, it does not have to be the end of the conversation. And if you want to get involved, please find us at Facebook, Sputnik International, likewise on Twitter. Thank you, and remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.